If you think about it, soil health could easily be considered the Holy Grail, a give and take at the highest level. It's a biodiversity concert of life. And September's solo guest, Graham Saight, is our biodiversity concert for life. He's got so much to share, you'll definitely want to listen more than once. I'm Robin Clare with Cultivated Audio. Come on, let's dig in. Graham, this may sound a bit crazy to some, but to me, your book, Nutrition Rules, is so exciting. And beyond that, it's a great confidence builder to be a better regenerative steward for healthy land, plants, animals, and people. So thank you so much for compiling all of those interviews.
Yes, it was interesting because it was part of my own learning experience, and the fact that I sort of identified at that point, it's quite some years back now, who I thought were the leading lights. Interestingly, that term, which is how this whole movement began, was under the term biological agriculture. At some point about 8 or 10 years ago, I actually did some market research on that term and found that the average consumer, when they heard the word, thought of guys in white coats tinkering with genes, or they thought of biological warfare. It actually wasn't a good term, and hence it's evolved into the regenerative agriculture concept. But I identified who I thought, the 22 people I thought were leading lights, and some of them were relatively unknown at that point. But interestingly, it was my learning experience to read all of their papers, read their books, and then I realized that my learning experience could be others' learning experience.
I've been fortunate through the years to have a few of those people as well on a show I started 20 plus years ago, Tributaries Radio, which is different from what I'm doing with Cultivated Audio. And I was happy to catch Charles. It was after he basically had retired and was blind at that point. Bruce Tainio, my gosh, I mean, all these people. I did miss Phil Callahan, which I was disappointed about.
He was a wonderful character.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm much overdue, but I'm sort of three quarters of the way through a book on what my term for this kind of approach has been, nutrition farming. When we realized the biological farming concept was kind of dead in the water, I coined the term nutrition farming. It's just another term to apply specifically to root cause of everything, which comes down to nutrition. So it will be out probably within the next 5 or 6 months. My podcast, which is the Nutrition Farming Podcast, has been really, really popular. So, you know, that's good.
Especially for farmers, I tried to instigate something like what I'm doing now a few years back, and I was trying to talk it up because farmers have no time. They're always working.
No.
But if they're in their truck, they can listen to a podcast, right? So
exactly. And I don't know why. It's silly that I never thought of it. I should have embraced it years ago. But better late than never.
Right, exactly. And I have listened to a few of those, and they're wonderful, needless to say. You know, you're talking about the nutrition and the soil and all of that. And I'm wondering if you have found some basic misconceptions going on about the carbon cycle. And it seems like so many people are stuck on the emissions problem. If they could look to the farm, they would certainly learn and see, wow, here's where big changes are going to be made, right?
You're so correct. It's the huge story that's increasingly been recognized at a scientific level, but many of us have been sort of screaming from the mountaintop trying to drive home the importance. And the very simple message is that there's only the same number of carbon molecules that have been here since the start of time, and they cycle between three places, the soil, carbon-based life forms, plants, animals, humans, and the atmosphere, that's CO2. And the largest storehouse is the carbon in the soil. There's also inorganic carbon like calcium carbonate and so forth in the soil as well. But the largest single storehouse of carbon in the total pool is what's in the soil as organic matter or humus. In the last 10 or 12 decades, we've gone from 5% organic matter down to 1.5% organic matter, which equates to 476 gigatons of CO2 that used to be in the soil and is now in that blanket, trapping the heat and changing our world. And the simple fact is that during that similar period since 1860, you know, motor vehicles, 7.4 billion people breeding CO2 and many more animals doing the same, industry, coal fire, power stations and so forth. So it's almost double what's come from the soil. But the exciting thing about that equation is that when we change the way that we farm, and we can just change and begin building organic matter. When we build organic matter, you can't say, oh, I made some new carbon, because there is no such thing. You've stepped into the carbon cycle and directly sequestered what otherwise would have been in the atmosphere. So it's the greatest way of carbon sequestration, and it's the most powerful. If you look at the situation where you guys put up 8 billion, roughly, tons of CO2. If you just built 1% organic matter in the cultivated soils, and it's actually easy to do in grazing soils, but if you just did that in the cultivated soils, that pulls back 4.5 billion of the 8 billion, which is actually more than what's needed to save the day. So it's just the ultimate and most powerful strategy, and there's not enough people who understand that. So I thank you for your work in trying to drive that home.
Yes. Also, Graham, you just mentioned about the soil and...
One topical branch out on a recent group of studies, or two studies out of the UK, in this regenerative model, have understood the potential of using basalt crusher dust, you know, fine basalt material that's used for road base and so forth. And the fine dust that's not really of much use, it has been thought of originally as a sort of broad spectrum mineralization because, of course, it contains the full spectrum of minerals. But you mentioned Professor Phil Callahan, and of course, he was the guy that came up with the concept of paramagnetism, this recognition that volcanic soils are the most productive soils on the planet partially because of this thing called paramagnetism. And these basalts are tremendously paramagnetic, and so they're actually quite cheap biostimulating fertilizer over here. You can buy them for about $15 a ton, and increasingly people have recognized that potential. But the exciting thing in this new research was not about the biostimulation, but the fact that these basalts have been shown to, I can't actually grasp the mechanism, but the short story is that basically they're a wonderful tool to build inorganic carbon and sequester carbon in that fashion. So it's a whole different story, and I need to understand the mechanics of that. I only just read the paper a few days back, and I need to reread it. So you've got a double hit when you use these very inexpensive paramagnetic basalt crusher dust, because you've got this biostimulation. Well, actually, it's a three-way hit. You've got the paramagnetic effect, you've got biostimulation and the mineralization, and you've also got the sequestration of carbon in the inorganic form that's stimulated by the crusher dust. So that's another great tool relative to the regenerative model.
Yes, and I know that Dr. Kerry Reams, he was into the soft phosphate mineral rock. I never heard it from that reference with Dr. Reams as being part of the carbon sequestration.
He hadn't grasped that concept, but that's right. Rock phosphate, of course, is nicely mineralized, and it's a great source of calcium and phosphate and silica as well, actually.
Yes, I found it to be a great supplement for humans to take as well.
Well, it's fascinating with Kerry Reams' work. He's probably better known with his work in human health. So he uses similar tools like immune conductivity and uses a refractometer to measure urine bricks and so forth. And there's a whole set of correlations of where you need to be with pH conductivity and bricks. There are not just alternative practitioners. There are actually conventional integrative physicians who have embraced it. But they're very, very enthusiastic about the results they're seeing. So, yeah, that's interesting to see that Kerry Reams' work carried on probably more in the human health realm than it is in the soil.
Right. And I think Kerry Reams is only starting to become known. He's one of these geniuses that was underground for a long time, and I think he's rising again. As we all know, soil is alive, and I'm an amateur farmer, gardener kind of person, but I've been working in human healthcare alternatively for quite some years now, and you can have two people come in with the same illness, and they will need different supplementation, different things to improve their health, even though it looks on paper like they have the same thing. Now, soils, I'm sure, must be the same way.
No, it's a very good question, and it's so true in the human health realm that it's very much an individualistic thing, and that's what's been the problem with the modern medical machine. You just take this drug and that fixes the problem, and it's really a question of symptoms. And the model of treating symptoms is almost a definition of unsustainable, because the facts are that we've used more chemicals every year for the last 10 decades. Last year was a 14.7% increase in total chemical usage. The year before, 14.4. The year before that, 14.1. Every single year, there's an increase in, and every 0.1% is thousands of tons more chemicals that are piled onto our soils and into our food and into our children. In that equation, the interesting thing is that every year for 10 decades, without exception, we put more on and we actually had more global pests. So there's an increase in disease pressure every year, despite putting more and more chemicals on. And that is literally the definition of unsustainable. And when we look at the parallel model in human health, we find that the largest killer on the planet remains heart disease, but the third largest killer, stroke's been relegated to the fourth largest killer. Our new third largest killer is prescription medicine. And I mean, that is the indictment of a failed system, and it's directly parallel to the concept of treating symptoms with chemicals in agriculture, just as we've done with human health, just as we've done with animal health. And all three of them have failed in a sense that we're not winning. You know, we're just treating symptoms rather than addressing the root causes. And so the key principle in this whole regenerative thing is that farming's getting more and more expensive because you're just creating more and more problems. And so we need to get back to understanding why. It's not an accident when you've got a fungal disease. It's not bad luck when you get cancer. There's always a reason. And there's more money in not addressing that reason and just treating symptoms way past time that we've got back to root causes. And that's what the whole essence of this approach is saying, well, okay, you know, there are several steps, but just a simple one, for example, is how does a fungal disease organism, what's its mode of action? Well, it drills through quite a substantial cell wall to get into the center of the cell, which is like the yolk of an egg. That's the food source. And a little sap-sucking insect will do the same. It will crunch through that cell wall to get to that yolk, that center of the cell, that food source. And so the obvious physical strategy is to say, okay, what's that cell wall made of? And what could I do to strengthen that cell wall, buckle the hyphae of the invading fungi, wear off the mandibles of the little sap-sucking insect? And the answer to that question on cell strength to create a stronger physical barrier, the two minerals, the two key minerals in cell wall strength are calcium and silica. Now, we test for calcium, obviously, in the soil, but sometimes leaf testing or plant tissue testing is actually a better strategy than soil testing, because what you do is just saying, what do you want, plant? Oh, that's what you want.
Right,
okay, here
yes.
It is. It's really just identifying exactly what the plant's accessing, and it's not necessarily accessing what's shown to be present in the soil because of the interplay between minerals. One mineral can shut down another, or one can stimulate another. No mineral is an island. They all impact each other. And the leaf test is just a direct, what is the plant getting, and how can you correct any shortages? Just to complete that little story, when we do leaf test, we want to see the most important is calcium, because it directly affects the uptake of seven other minerals. We call it the trucker of all minerals. We work in 57 countries. The vast majority need more calcium in terms of the luxury levels that we're seeking for that protective response. So the foliar strain of calcium is almost critical for every crop to get that calcium in. And then when we look at silica, you'd think, well, silica is the most abundant mineral literally on the planet, with iron second. I mean, the core of the earth is silica. Clays are aluminosilicate. Sands in the soil are silica. But what we understand now, this is a plant's uptake silica in the form called monosilicic acid, and we need on a soil test 100 parts per million of that soluble, that plant available form of silica, which that strengthens cell walls and strengthens stems and so forth. And what's been discovered is certainly the more chemical the farm, the lower the level. So obviously the chemistry is affecting a yet-to-be-identified group of microorganisms that are solubilizing the huge amount of insoluble silica present in the soil and making it available for plants. And we don't yet know which group of organisms, and there might be several of them. Big, huge finding with silica is that it's not just about stem strength and cell strength and protection. It's also now been recognized to be what's called an immune elicitor. And so that's a whole fascinating, relatively new field of science, where we understand that plants have an immune system, immune elicitors that can boost that immune system. Certain organisms produce biochemicals that stimulate plant immunity, and you can brew those organisms up and introduce them into your soil, and you've got a plant that can fight its own fight, and you don't need to use the chemicals. So that's sort of part of that model.
But the silica, for instance, you said you put it on the soil. Is that something that is just the silica?
There's a material called diatomaceous earth, which is just filled with trillions of diatoms, and all that's left is their outer skeleton, which is 87% silica, and it just looks like lime or gypsum.
Mm-hmm.
And you grind that down, and it's very, very plant available, one of the strategies that we use. So it's quite effective, and you can just polyspray that and lift the silica levels in the plant and create this much more resilient plant. It's been tremendous in things like hydroponics. The downside to hydroponics is that there's no soil, so there's no silica, because all the soils contain some silica. They have two key groups of fertilizers that don't go with each other, so you have a tank A and a tank B. Well, with silica, you've got to add a third tank, because the soluble form of silica doesn't go with anything, basically. So you put it out by itself, and you try and achieve that 100 parts per million that I mentioned in the soil. Will you achieve that in the solution? And it's just transformative in hydroponics agriculture. You don't have the powdery mildew on your cucumbers and so forth. So it's a great finding. The silica is a wonderful material that we can bring into agriculture to reduce the need for chemicals.
That sounds amazing. So are you finding that many people know about this, and are they doing it when they're using hydroponics?
Yes. Increasingly, I mean, obviously, there's several of us out there around the world. In my case, I was traveling to 25 to 30 countries a year teaching prior to COVID, of course. And so even though I'm doing for groups all around the world online 2 and 3 hour courses and so forth, and just taking single large farms in different countries and talking to their managers, it's not the same. I discovered quite late in life that that was my passion. I just love it and I'm missing it so much.
I bet.
We have a seminar centre here at the Nutritech Centre, and we usually have our 5-day courses, which are quite sort of famous around the world. People come from all over. It's a very different, very changed world. But anyway, what can you do? There's a lot of people suffering more than I am at the moment.
Right, yes. And you can talk on cultivated audio.
Yeah, that's true, and I'm happy to do that.
So, Graham, yes, as we just said, all soils are different, especially when you're looking at climates and you're looking at environment. Is it a silly question to ask you if there are any universal keys for building and maintaining mineral balance in soil?
There are, and it's so interesting. I've got three research farms, and I was up at my new one, which is quite a large apple operation that produces 5.5 million apples.
That's a lot of apples.
Yeah, it's a lot of trees. So we're taking it from 40 years of chemicals, and the starting point is to clean the soil up. But there's a very, very good trick in terms of pulling chemical residues out of the soil, and it involves a natural material called fulvic acid, which is extracted from certain forms of brown coal. And at high doses, there's quite good research now that you can sort of clean soils up. It speeds the biodegradation of any small amounts of chemical residue. Humus and compost can do that anyway, but part of the reason they're doing that is that compost and humus contain that natural acid, fulvic acid, so you're just fast-tracking that by putting larger amounts of this natural substance into the equation. So that's been the starting point with that farm, to at least clear the chemicals out so the biology's got a much better chance of functioning well. The essence of the whole approach is minerals, microorganisms and humus, and the interplay between those three things. And the starting point with minerals is always calcium. Home gardeners don't do soil tests, so they're kind of driving blind. I mean, I was talking to a lovely old couple up at the apple farm. He does some work mending our tractors, and his wife's a very, very keen gardener. She's a lovely lady. And we were chatting, and she was having a few problems and stuff, and I mentioned, when did you lime last? She said, I've never limed. And she's gardened for 30 years there and never put any calcium on. And she said, I didn't know that it was that necessary. And so there just isn't the recognition and understanding of how important calcium is in the equation. And the reason for the importance is that the most important single element for plant growth and soil health is not nitrogen, phosphorus or potassium, and it's not calcium. Well, it is calcium indirectly. The most important single element is oxygen. It's all about the breathing of that soil. All of the beneficial microbes are highly aerobic. There is actually a group of anaerobes, but we're talking about the key organisms, aerobic. The roots, of course, have got to have oxygen for all of the functions. And so you need to have that soil open and breathing, basically. And it's a two-way exchange. We actually call it gas exchange because you want the soil open so that oxygen can diffuse from the atmosphere down into the soil. And then once it's been used by the roots and the organisms around those roots, they breathe out, and of course you've got this concentration of CO2 that now diffuses up, and the plant leaf's waiting with thousands of tiny pores under each leaf called stomates that suck up that CO2, and that's the key building block along with sunlight and water to photosynthesize, to produce the glucose building block, which is the building block of all living things. It's the most important process on the planet. And when you grow things, that's what you're doing. You're managing gas exchange and you're managing photosynthesis, and the two go hand in hand. And why calcium's so important in that equation, all minerals have in their smallest particle size ions. Yes. And calcium's a large ion. It's like a beach ball. And so it has a positive charge on each side of that beach ball, and it grabs hold of the tiny little clay colloids, which are negatively charged, and has one stuck on each side, for argument's sake, and it pushes apart those colloids, and that's called flocculation. And that opens up the soil, and in comes the oxygen freely, and out comes the CO2. And so you've just perfected or mastered gas exchange. So calcium's the starting point, and calcium affects directly the uptake of quite a range of trace minerals. 7 minerals are impacted by the presence of calcium. And interestingly, if you overdo calcium and you put on, say, twice what you need, it's actually worse than not liming, because calcium then antagonizes the uptake of the same 7 minerals. The key to getting calcium right for a starting point. Realistically, if you're a passionate home gardener, you want to put a value to your time, consider the home garden to be the ultimate wellness tool, because you're getting this fresh food.
Yes.
And it's not just chemical-free fresh food. It's understanding that our food has been on the shelf for 2, 3, 4 days. And if you look at how fast nutrition is lost, a snow pea in 12 hours loses 50% of its vitamin C. So you're eating champagne food. You're eating food that's most nutrient-dense. And if you've grown it well, and you've grown it without chemicals, and you've grown it with plenty of compost and all those sorts of things, I mean, you've got real medicine. The founder of modern medicine said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. And almost on a daily basis, we're recognizing how profound that concept was as we discover these phytonutrients and their impact on our health.
Yes, and the vegetables are so filled with water. And I think that's a place where the minerals hang out, too. So you can taste the minerals.
The flavor, taste and nutrient density are the same thing. One of the problems with the sort of modern kind of extractive agriculture model is that we've become over-enamored with a mineral called nitrogen, which is a really important mineral. It's the most abundant mineral on the planet. But because it gives such an obvious response, I call it moron approach of a little bit works good. Let's put more on. Called the moron approach. And what it does is the antagonistic effect of nitrogen is that you shut down potassium, which governs the movement of sugars into fruit, and it actually governs the size of grain and fruit and vegetables and so forth. So that's not a good outcome if you're a commercial grower. And then it's in second, and calcium, now you've got weak cell walls, and you're going to have insect pressure and so forth, and disease pressure. But when you do have too much nitrogen, which is so common, in the nitrate form, because there are two forms of nitrogen, nitrates are always uptaken with water, and the downside of having a plant that's too watery is that you've diluted that mineral density.
Right.
So if you're measuring, which is a really important tool, even for home gardeners, and it came from Carrie Reams.
Reams.
Reflectometer, that's a simple little tool. It's just a little sawn-off telescope. You squeeze, crush a few drops of juice. The light refracts through the dissolved solids, and that juice, when you hold it up and the sun shines, and you get a reading, it's called brick levels, the active index of the plant. And it's hugely important because it's just a measure of how nutrient dense. And if you just put on a whole dose of nitrogen in commercial agriculture and then you measure your brick level, it always drops because of that dilution effect. And so the higher the nitrogen, the lower the bricks, and the less the food value is the equation. So in your home garden, at least if you can't afford to do a soil test or whatever, if you've got a little refractometer, which you can buy on eBay or Amazon really inexpensively, you've got an incredible tool to know how well you're gardening, basically. So to look through it, there's two hemispheres. It's like an old school fuel tank in a car with a line crossing across, and that's the central axis. And where the line crosses that, that's the bricks reading. And you chase higher than 12 degrees bricks, and the better. But if you've only got 4 degrees in your garden, you've got some work to do because you're not producing nutrient-dense food. In fact, you've probably got a lot of pest and disease pressure, and you're not having much fun gardening. So the refractometer is just invaluable for everyone in that context. It lets you know how well you're doing.
Absolutely.
I mentioned the calcium store. So that line, if that line is very, very distinct and sharp, that's quite conclusively been shown to be linked to low calcium levels. And so you want to have just a big fuzzy line running across the natural axis. And that's what you're chasing. You're seeking the fuzz. You don't want that sharp line. The sharp line is a lack of calcium. So that means you've got a calcium meter and, you know, a nutrient density rule in one tool for $30 in the home garden, as it is. It's an indispensable tool in agriculture.
When you've got the fuzzy with the refractometer, it also shows you the calcium. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, if it's fuzzy, that line that's the biggest indication of calcium. And if it's sharp and distinct, you need to do some calcium.
Oh, excellent. That's a great tip.
Yeah.
You could have this little 5-minute show, you know, we're going tips, hot tips from Grams.
I've just completed a 6-hour online course on home gardening, and it's the most ridiculously comprehensive thing. But I branch out because I'm also a human nutrition specialist. So I teach people how to make fermented food and a range of other things as part of that course. But yeah, it's much more involved than any other home garden course ever, I think, but particularly in COVID times.
Right. So perfect, really, because, for instance, we have a big election coming up this November, and go be a good citizen and vote. And of course, I agree 100%, but I'm feeling like to be a good citizen, let's learn how to have healthy soil and let's learn how to take care of ourselves and be healthy.
Yes,
there are so many basic points that aren't very difficult to manage or just to learn.
And within that context, and you guys leading the world now with your 200,000 plus fatalities associated with this disease, no one has mentioned, and I don't want to offend you or whatever, or offend your listeners, but it's just the reality, and someone should be saying it, and they're not, is that why have you had that horrific outcome? And the very strong point here that's not been driven home and needs to be is that you have very high consumption of sugar and the refined carbohydrates. You've got many, many, many people with type 2 diabetes, and a greater number that it would be pre-diabetic. And what this disease is essentially, it's almost more of a blood disease, and it's huge, the impact rates for people who are pre-diabetic, who have diabetes, and that's the major reason, because you guys lead the world, and second in the world, incidentally, is India. But the missing part of the story, and I have one of my podcasts, I've sort of branched down just to the human health podcast, just out of frustration, surely, you know, sanitize, wash the skin off, and put on our masks and so on. I mentioned about there's a series of things you can do to boost immunity. Everyone in the world should be doing that, and they're told, and it's just like a criminal oversight that we haven't been told, look, you've got to have zinc, you've got to have magnesium, and even iodine, which most turns out are deficient. And anyway, if anyone wants to hear that podcast, they can hear the story on what you desperately need to be doing to make sure that you've got some resilience and some resistance. And even if you get it, you can fight it off very easily, and then hopefully you've got immunity. But anyway, another story.
For farmers and ranchers that are having to plant on land that has been NPK'd to death, there's something, is it called locked in? And then actually we just heard the remedy.
Well, basically what happens is that it becomes a treadmill for the growers, that there's a range of the sort of hybridized, and particularly the GM crops that are designed for high NPK, and so you kind of get into this scenario where just basically putting more and more on for less and less response. And so, as I said, it's really past time to recognize that the first cell that is from the Precambrian Ocean has 74 minerals, and there are no accidents in the perfect blueprint called nature. If there were 74 minerals there, there's some studies in Western Australia with three rare earth minerals, and I can't even remember their names because they're so sort of unfamiliar. And they're finding all these tremendous results as the seed treatment and so forth, that's just totally unheard of. But all of those minerals play a role. And what Justus von Liebig, the German chemist, did was, when you burn 100 kilos of plant matter, for example, or 100 pounds, you've got 5 kilos or 5 pounds of ash as a byproduct. And that ash represents basically the minerals that were present in that crop, that are present in the ash. In fact, that's how you do a leaf test. You ash and you analyze the ash. And so he had the technology that was there 10 or 12 decades back. He analyzed the ash and said, well, the basis of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, he didn't have the measuring technology to identify trace minerals, because trace minerals are there in tiny amounts because they're spark plugs. They're not structural. They're not like calcium or nitrogen and potassium that are part of the cell. They are just like little spark plugs that trigger reactions. It doesn't reduce their importance. It's just that there's not much of them from a physical perspective. There's much less of them. So he'd missed that. We said, well, look, we've got disused armaments factories everywhere. We can make NPK. And someone developed the Haber-Bosch technique to pull nitrogen from the atmosphere and so forth. And so we began this dumbing down of nutrition, basically, where previously we'd had animal manures and cover crops and all sorts of strategies that have been there for tens of thousands of years that obviously worked, and that's why we did them. But now we just said, okay, we can put it on from a bag. And so every time we remove a crop, we take a little bit of all 74 minerals that were once present in the soil. Right. And now we're putting back three things. So we're taking 74 and putting back three. And if you look at it historically, it was about between 10 and 15 years after that simplistic dumbed down nutrition that we started to see this huge increase in pest and disease pressure. The reflection of nutrition is, so rather than saying, is it linked to this dumbed down nutrition that's putting on three things when you took 74 off, the science stepped up to the plate and said that we can develop these rescue chemicals, and they did. We then began coming and creating the problem with a dumbed down nutrition, and then to put more and more chemicals on every year. The story on that is horrific, because there's a study that I can't relocate now. I had it printed and I can't find it in the files because it was about 8 years ago. But basically in that study, in your country, they looked at 1,400 school children, 700 from rural areas and 700 from urban areas, and they looked at the 23 most commonly used farm chemicals. And to the horror of the researchers, they couldn't find a single child, according to FDA standards, who didn't have unacceptable levels in their tissues, urine and blood. We know that there is no debates about childhood leukemia being linked to environmental chemicals, not just from the farm, from other places as well. And leukemia is the largest killer of children now. So, you know, if we can do it better, and we can get back to root causes and reduce this ridiculous flood of these toxic chemicals, then we need to be doing that, and that's what the whole regenerative model is about.
Right. Yeah. I thought it even had a worse effect of sort of locking in what was there, so it was unavailable.
I mean, there is that interplay between minerals. First, when you put soluble phosphorus into the soil, it's got three negative charges, so it's drawn like a nail to a magnet to anything with two positive charges, for example. So one of the problems with phosphorus is it grabs hold of calcium in the soil and forms this insoluble material called calcium phosphate. And basically, when people apply soluble phosphorus like DAP or MAP or superphosphate, they only get 27% of the material they put on there. That's scientifically acknowledged. And the other almost three quarters becomes this huge bank of locked up phosphate in the soil. And so in Australia here, you know, we're much smaller than you from an agricultural perspective, but it's a big island. But in Australia here, it's been estimated by our government agricultural body that there's about $10 billion, and that's very, very conservative, of locked up phosphate, this huge reserve of locked up phosphate. So part of the biological approach, or the regenerative approach, or what I call the nutrition farming approach, is to employ simple strategies that can release some of that frozen reserve. And that means when you break the bond between calcium and phosphate and make both of them available again, you're getting both of those key minerals. And calcium and phosphorus together, this is the interesting part, most important single process on the planet by far, there is nothing that even comes slightly close. The most important process is photosynthesis. And yes, the two most important minerals for the most important process on the planet are calcium and phosphorus. So it's wonderful to release those two minerals and have them present to boost photosynthesis in whatever crop, whether it's a home garden or a commercial crop.
Yes. Yeah, now, so, do a good variety of microbes help bring minerals into balance?
Well, they do. There's literally a microorganism behind every mineral. So there are nitrogen-fixing organisms, obviously. And then when we look at that, I mean, it's getting a little complex, but with nitrogen-fixing organisms, for example, they're hugely important because the atmosphere has 74,000 tons, 5,000 truckloads of urea equivalent above every hectare. And the absolute massive amount of nitrogen in the atmosphere. And in fact, it's a hugely important part of a healthy plant because that gives us the nitrogen in the ammonium form rather than the nitrate form, because when we apply water-soluble nitrogen, most of it goes in the nitrate form with the water that carries nitrates in and then dilutes things. Ideally, we want three parts ammonium to one part nitrate within the plant, and you can never get that unless you're getting some for free from the atmosphere, which is always in the ammonium form. And part of that ammonium nitrogen, the leaf surface, which is called the phyllosphere, the plant is pumping out these carbon exudates, and it's covered in swarming biology, and amongst those microorganisms living on the leaf surface are creatures like a little bacteria that fix nitrogen from the atmosphere directly into the leaf. But to do that, whether you're in the soil doing that or on the leaf surface doing that, you need to have a little trace mineral called molybdenum, yes, because the enzyme you're producing to grab the ammonium nitrogen and put it into the soil or into the plant, that enzyme's called nitrogenase, and it's made from molybdenum. Now, 80% of the soils that we test at, and probably the same for home gardens, across the planet, 80% of the soils we test don't have anywhere enough molybdenum for that whole process to work. And you're only needing tiny, tiny amounts of this, like a pound per acre, but you're not getting the healthy plant with the good ratio of ammonium nitrogen that makes it more resilient and more disease resistant. So the whole story of biology and minerals, they are interrelated everywhere. There are phosphate solubilizing organisms. There are manganese reducing organisms that make manganese into a plant available form. There are potassium solubilizing. There are iron reducing. So the more microbial diversity, and everything comes back to diversity, I mean, it's the key for going to say we're going to learn from the blueprint that the key most important single thing in nature is biodiversity, without any doubt at all. And that's why we want to see the global movement towards these things called cocktail cover crops, where you try and get all these different species plants into your cover crop. You never leave soil bare ever, because when does nature do that? Because the plant is feeding and holding together and preserving that precious topsoil. Now, the issue about topsoil preservation is a massive and huge story.
Yes, absolutely.
Because the findings show us that at our current rate, 5 to 7 tons per acre of topsoil lost every year. And in 60 years, we've got zero. Now, we hit the wall way before 60 years. In 10 years, with 8 billion people with that loss, we're going to struggle to feed. I mean, it's the most important commodity, if you're going to call it a commodity. I mean, it totally eclipses gold and silver and platinum or whatever. Topsoil is the most precious substance on the planet, and we're losing it at that insane rate. So we need soil restoration initiatives yesterday, and a huge one of those is this concept of cover crops to feed the soil, and then of course you can turn them back into that soil. And the interesting thing is plants produce this glucose building block for everything, and then they pump half of that down to the roots, because the roots need glucose for everything they want. But then the interesting thing happens, the plants pump 60% of the half that they give to the roots, they pump out from their roots. So they give away 30% of the most precious substance that governs everything to their health and viability, they give away. And it's part of a central, like one of those huge, huge principles that drive nature and drive everything for that matter. And that concept is give and you will receive. A lot of people don't discover that until maybe they retire and they start volunteering and they have this sense of peace and wellness that they've never experienced before, and that's because you can't get what you don't give. It's the law of giving, you shall receive, and it's there at the most important process of all processes, photosynthesis. The plant gives away 30% of its most important substance, and the organisms are crowded around that plant with open mouth and ready to respond and give back based upon that food that they got given. And of course they give back probably more than what they got given in this two-way giving, you shall receive deal. And it's a wonderful lesson to all of us in that concept. But so what was discovered is the plants don't just pump glucose, they lace that glucose. If you're a banana plant and you love manganese, they love that particular trace mineral, then you lace your glucose that you're giving away to the organisms with substances that will attract manganese-reducing organisms around your roots. Basically, every plant laces its sugar exudates with whatever it needs for its requirements to feed the biology to give that. So you're going to have different organisms, basically, in that context. Basically, in the soil, the greater the diversity of organisms, the healthier your crop or your vegetable garden, the less need for chemical intervention, and the more medicinal that food. And so it's all about biodiversity, and the greater the diversity of plants, the greater the diversity above ground, the greater the diversity below ground. So that's a huge issue in agriculture when we embraced monoculture and we said, okay, let's just plant an entire field of strawberries or whatever. Even if you've got an orchard and you're growing avocados or citrus or whatever, and under that orchard you put that diversity with a multi-species cover crop, now you're at least addressing that huge mistake of monoculture, which is not how nature works, and it's part of the reason that we're having so many problems, because we're contrary to the central principle of nature, which is biodiversity. So we can counter that, and we can still have our monoculture, but by putting biodiversity under that in the form of these multi-species cover crops.
Right, that's a great point. And Graham, where do you see the next important line of inquiry going? I mean, we spoke a little bit about Callahan. He just had such brilliant research, right, and knowledge about the energetics of nutrition and how the insects will see these diseased plants that they go after all the time. There have been so many great researchers of late in microbes and soil restoration, et cetera. Do you think the path is well lit now, or do you see
I think that the move towards the regenerative thing is becoming kind of overwhelming. I mean, I had meetings with the minister in the UK in my last visit to talk about post-Brexit agriculture policy, and he had a tremendous understanding of the need for this regenerative change. And so it's kind of happening quite a scale. I mean, I work in Saskatchewan, which is average farm size is 15 or 20,000 acres, and I talk to groups that represent maybe a million acres at a time sort of thing. And they've adopted a series of biological strategies which has greatly reduced their chemicals. And the interesting part about that in almost every instance is that, you know, you've got a whole range of organisms in the soil, but the key two workers are the beneficial fungi and, of course, the very diverse range of bacteria. I mean, there are protozoa, there are beneficial nematodes, and, of course, there's the most visible thing, which is like the intestines of the soil, which is the earthworm. And most conventional farmers have not seen an earthworm in years, but we drive home the potential of how you can bring them back and what amazing range of benefits that can happen when that happens. But when we do soil life tests, which is part of the change, there are little simple little devices that you can buy just for a couple hundred dollars now that can measure microbial biomass and measure what's called the fungi to bacteria ratio. And the huge problem that exists with the current model is that almost every soil is lacking in these beneficial fungi. So there's a thing called the fungi to bacteria ratio, and different crops have different ratios they prefer, but all crops and almost every soil you test is lacking in these beneficial fungi. It's hugely important, because when we talk about humus, there are two types of humus, two types of organic matter. There's active organic matter and there's stable organic matter. So active organic matter is taking your lawn clippings, piling them in a corner. So your first barrow load, you come back with your second barrow load. I'm not sure if you've got lawns that you mow, but if you come back with your second barrow load of lawn clippings, the first pile is already red hot. You can put your hand inside, and that's bacteria chasing the dominant green pigment. The main mineral in that green is in chlorophyll is nitrogen, and they love nitrogen. They've got a 5-to-1 carbon nitrogen ratio, so bacteria go crazy on nitrogen. So they're in there, and it's easy to digest. They're a tiny little creature, 500,000 on a pinhead, and they're in there taking this easy to digest simple, and at the end of 3 months or 4 months, you've got a compost that the bacteria made, and you can pile that on your garden and see the garden change 2 or 3 shades darker, and then you get a nice result with your tomatoes and your cucumbers and your lettuces or whatever, and then you come back 6 months later for the next cycle, and that 3 shades dark has gone back to the same colour again, that active fumus created by bacteria, and it oxidises and returns to the atmosphere within 12 months. That's not what we're going to pay carbon credits for, and it's not what's going to save the planet. And that's the importance of fungi, because fungi will come along and they will take some of that bacterial humus and they'll make some themselves, and they'll basically bind up the humus and they tie humus and clay together and create this humus clay colloid. And now you've stabilised the carbon, and that carbon will stay in the soil for 35 years minimum, some say longer. And that's stable versus active, which is the bacterial form, which has only got a 12-month shelf life. And we don't have the fungi. The most important creatures on the planet are these cellulose digesting saprophytic fungi that create that stable humus that will last there for 35 years and keep it out of the atmosphere and help save the planet. So they are immeasurably important, and they'll act in almost every soil. And when we have some of my larger conferences, and we bring growers from all over the world to speak at that conference, almost every time they'll say, when we used this simple little cheap device to measure fungi to bacteria ratio, and when we saw we started increasing our fungi, everything changed on the farm. It was the essence. Bacteria release a sticky substance to create a tiny little crumb, a little aggregate, and the fungi will roll the crumbs together and create a much larger aggregate. And that opens the soil up so that when you get rain, you know, and we're getting less rain everywhere, but when we get rain, it infiltrates. It's a hugely important word in the climate change world, infiltration. You want that water in there as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And if you've got fungi present with those larger crumbs, in comes the water, in comes the oxygen, out flows the CO2 for photosynthesis. That's the perfect soil, and you can't achieve it without fungi, and fungi are lacking in every soil. Even in your home garden, you need to have this fungi, and I sort of teach all of the strategies you can use to do that.
Well, let me just ask you one more question. Tell us about your company, Nutritech Solutions, and why it not only fits into this picture, but it greatly enhances it. Greatly enhances it.
Okay, so I formed a company 26 years ago, on the basis of, I had a young daughter who was hit by a car, a six-year-old, outside of a school, and was horrifically injured and all the bones broken. She died twice on the way to hospital, then lay in a coma with massive brain damage for 3 months. During that period, you don't sort of think of those things when you're an organ donor, which is showing up as an organ, but they just kept on coming and saying, can we turn off the machines? Can we turn off the machines? Because she'll only ever be a vegetable, and a little Sally who wants her kidneys and someone else who wants her eyes and so forth. And, you know, you sort of don't contemplate in that scenario. But anyway, I hung in and refused. And she sort of stabilized after having a couple of close shaves, had to have a shunt because of the pressure building in the brain and so forth while she was in the coma. And then the machines all started beeping. The machines we'd come to know and hate all started beeping, and they said, well, sorry, this is brain death approaching. Within 3 or 4 hours, she'll be dead. Her brain will die. And so I'm not personally religious, but I know there's a God there, and so I find God in nature when I'm on my farm. So I sort of made this deal that should she survive, I would do something of value. 20 minutes later, she came out of the coma, so that's where it came from.
Yeah.
I had a sleep this night thinking, what could I do of value that I sort of promised I'd do something of value? And I developed this growing passion for soil and nutrition. I had no conception at that point of the relevant soil health and planetary health, which is kind of the biggest link. And as I researched and as I continued the journey, and once I recognized that, that became my driving thing, and then teach people how to do that. And so something of a mission. It's not a normal company in that context. If you've heard me speak, you'll understand there's a touch of evangelical in there and trying to drive this change. And I'm walking the talk. We've got 3, 4, 5 divisions in the company. We've got what we call nutrition farms, which are these 3 farms, and we have a whole range of value-added products under this lovely Nutrition Farms logo, including these apples will be in brown bags with a window that's made of biodegradable hemp plastic, and the logo says chemical-free, nutrient-dense, forgotten flavours. So the Nutrition Farms model is one part of it. Then we've got a home garden division, we've got a human health division. I've developed a whole range of human health products, and you can check out nthealth.com for those. And then, of course, we've got education, and so we have these courses which we've trained something like 45,000 farmers and consultants around the world on 4 continents. And then we have my blog, and then we have my podcast as well. So that's the path that we've headed down, and we've got an animal health division. So there's quite a lot of stuff happening. But my passion at the moment for this new farm, this big farm, and to demonstrate, so we're putting all the cover crops in between because it is monoculture. But then I had a smaller farm in that region. I've transplanted 3,000, sorted everything, plums and peaches and nectarines and apricots and so forth. But between all the rows, we've got raised beds, and then we grow garlic in the winter, and then we grow, you know, a whole range of vegetables. Really, we've got the biodiversity, and between those raised beds and the tree rows, we've got cover crops. And so it's kind of a demonstration. We'll have a shop, and there'll be a teaching Institute. So that's what we're doing on that front. I'm finding that tremendously exciting. It's like a child in a candy shop as we set up a 40-foot container that I'm calling Nutrition Central. And that's the other part of your question about where do you think things are heading. There's a huge potential for smart agriculture tied to the regenerative model, and people haven't really cottoned on to that potential. And I want to demonstrate on that new farm that whole model. For example, we've analysed all the soils. We know that there are 9 minerals that are going to require some correction during the season, both with foliar and fertigating, you know, putting it out through the irrigation and nutrition. So we've got 9 drums covering those minerals, and then we've got a 1,000-litre mixing tank and a 1,000-litre fertigation tank, which means you pump from that tank through the irrigation to feed the whole orchard. Mm. Then we've got key things like humic acid and fulvic acid and kelp and 1,000-litre containers. So they're all lined up inside this container. They've all got these smart valves on them, so they're all tied to each other with a controller. This is part of this smart agriculture. And so you can just push on your phone from wherever you and you just click on your phone and all the mixing, everything happens and it all gets delivered out to everyone. Everywhere. We've got programmers working on the 13 most common diseases. We'll have drones flying around there, and you've got to have something like 10,000 photos of each disease to program the analysis of it. But the drones can fly twice a day through the entire orchard and identify the very first touch of any of these 13 diseases. And with GPS, you'll just get a message and a beep, well, go and sort that tree out now so it can't spread and you can solve the issue. And that's what I'm demonstrating. There are multiple things, like tracking your food and knowing about your food. So on the sticker on each apple, there's no guesswork, and you can't cheat because it's all tied to blockchain, so it's happening in real time. It's more transparent than organics in that context.
Yes.
This isn't organics, it's nutrition farming. So you can just put your phone on that little label and it'll tell you the nutrition farming story about what we did and what happened to that apple, its entire journey. So with all of that kind of thing, we're building into that smart model tied to the regenerative model.
Right. It's funny that the word organic really doesn't mean very much anymore.
No, it's been sort of diluted a little, hasn't it? In my country, you know, organics is this manual, basically, of you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. And there's not one word in that manual about what you should be doing
right.
to produce nutrient-dense, yeah. chemical-free food with high medicinal qualities. And so nutrition farming is the opposite. In fact, we've started in India with some very large coffee growers, the very first nutrition farming certification, and much more thorough than organics because it's all about the good stuff. If you did half of what we suggest to qualify for certification, you would have a wonderful crop with forgotten flavours and greater medicinal value. So it's a different emphasis in organics in that context because it's all about producing wonderful, high-quality food sort of thing.
Right. Well, I can't say you're down a path. I think you are down some kind of super highway or something, and it's bigger than that. You know, one thing I would like to ask you, I've been having trouble reaching somebody in India, and I always thought I'd try and do the dairy because the cow is always so sacred and special in India. I've only been able to find most of the dairy farmers, they're smaller and they don't speak English, so.
It's not the industrial dairy model at all, but it's fascinating. I will digress into that. We'll talk about that for a second because it's got tremendous unrecognized potential.
Oh, of course.
Rudolf Steiner made the comment that a farm's not a farm without cattle, and he's specific about that form of livestock.
Right.
But when you look at the Indian scenario, you understand what Steiner was talking about. The animal, of course, which is the cow's considered sacred, but they have half a dozen or a dozen cows, and they bring them back to their concrete shed with a sloped floor with drains around the outside edge, and a cow will drop like 100 litres of urine at night. And so they collect all of that urine and they do this simple fermentation with a little bit of molasses. And that urine becomes the essence of their foliar spray, and that's where they get their nitrogen. Because the highest source of nitrogen, if we're talking about human or animal byproducts, is not poo, it's the urine. And urea is a natural substance. But there's lots of other nutrients in that urine that we just flush it away.
Right. The Manamutra practice of drinking your own urine, that's where it started.
I was there, actually, the Prime Minister there at one point, and this guy had won the Indian of the Year sort of thing, and he was a large-scale organic, or large-scale for their country, organic grower, but I was on his farm and witnessed the health of the crops. They're using the manure and they're making vermicompost, they have worm beds, and then they make teas from the vermicompost, and then they make just the conventional compost from the manure, and then the urine is the essence of the entire thing. And he showed me some seedling treatment trials where they'd used the amniotic fluid, yellowish-orange material, and it was just phenomenal, this amniotic fluid. Diluted at 1 to 500. So we've got a lot to learn about the potential of working with livestock a bit more closely than we have.
Yes.
You don't want to be doctoring them up with all the chemicals we do currently in the Western model because
right.
they don't use any chemicals over there on their animals because they are considered sacred. So, yeah, it's an exciting story.
This is like the gold mine that everybody can have.
Yes. is the big story that makes them lose yield, because it's so much more inexpensive to just put some urea on is
obviously
a much cheaper option. But the, what they didn't know was the science of the fact you can actually brew up, for example, now in terms of reducing costs, you can brew specific nitrogen-fixing organisms, and as long as you've got that little trace mineral called molybdenum to allow that nitrogen fixation process to work, and you only need a tiny amount of that in the equation, you can spray it on the soil and get a lot of your nitrogen for free for very, very little investment. You can set up a 1,000-litre brewing tank for a few hundred dollars, Lee, and we teach people how to do that. And you can brew these things up, and you can do things more cost-effectively than was ever possible before, now that we understand the workings of biology and working with them rather than against them, which is what we've done in the extractive model for a lot of years. So can't not be passionate when you get involved in this. And it's so lovely to work and see people change from kind of a fear-driven model. And food production is the most important single profession. If you're not having fun in your profession, you know, you need to find something else to do, because you've got such a short life, it's over in such a short time, that you've got to be passionate. Whatever it is, you know, on that treadmill model of just putting more and more chemicals on, and it is not fun. And one thing we've discovered, for example, with tissue testing, with leaf testing, is that if you can get four minerals on that leaf test in what we call the luxury zone, we call it the big four, calcium, phosphorus, boron and magnesium. If you can get them at luxury levels on the leaf test, it's just amazing, the resilience, the lack of disease and insect pressure, the yield, but most importantly, the fun that you have farming. But what we find, because we work in 57 countries with teams of agronomists and so forth, and we look at thousands and thousands of these leaf tests, we find that 30% of farmers with those four minerals that determine resilience and productivity and farming fun, 30% of them have got all four of them deficient. So when we're talking about luxury zones, normally you want 0.2 to 0.6. Well, a luxury zone is 0.6. 30% of people have got all four of that, most important, because those four minerals are the most important minerals for photosynthesis and the most important process. And they don't know, and they're not having fun farming at all. They're having sleepless nights wondering what disease is going to hit them next. And they don't know why. And so it's become hugely passionate to get out and say, look, this is why. Correct these things and you're going to have fun farming. You're going to get passionate about it again, because you should be passionate.
Wow. So much to learn. I could listen to that again right now. This is Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Podcasts are where you like, and if not, let us know. All right, here we are. Thanks, everyone, for making Here Where We Want to Be.